Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to MOR Chat. I'm Linda Fissler. And this evening we have a very special guest with us. Sherry McGraw will be joining us to talk about her book, The Language of Drawing, and also to talk about abstract realism. So wanted to take a few minutes and talk a little bit about that book and everything. As you know, it's a best-selling book, and a lot of the artists actually think of it as a Bible because it helps us with our drawing skills. And that has to do, you know, a lot with the beginning of a drawing and how successful your painting, and then how successful your painting is going to be later on as you come to the finish. A real strong start equals a great and very strong painting, and I'm sure Sherry will tell us more about that. And also in the house tonight, we have Blanche McAllister-Harris and Barbara Coleman, who are my two co-hosts. So I want to say hello to Blanche and bring her in now. How you doing, Blanche?
Hey, Linda, I'm doing really well. How about you?
Oh, I'm doing better, thank you. So, had a wonderful time in Yosemite and relaxing after weekend with the Masters, which was, you know, a really great three shows and very, very busy time. And Sherry was also at weekend with the Masters, so we'll talk with her a little bit about that, too. But other than
I know you guys had a great time.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun, and I need to write a couple blogs, I think, out on my website about all the stuff that happened and how much fun it was. But it certainly is worth going to if they do have one in the future, and it was a lot of fun seeing them, and the participants were having a great time with all of the instructors, and it was just busy from sun up to sundown, really. So just a great time.
Yeah.
What have you been up to?
Well, I've been doing a little painting over the last few days. The weather here is just beginning to feel like fall. It's cooled off and the humidity has gone down, and beautiful blue sky. So I've been taking advantage of that.
Good.
Getting a little bit of outdoor painting.
Oh, good. Good. That'll always test the skills.
Yeah.
All right. And then we have Barbara, too. How are you doing, Barbara?
I'm doing very well, thank you. I was just saying before we went on air that I just was rushing to wash the paint off my fingers. I'm painting for a show up in Denver, up in Evergreen again, their miniature masterpiece show I've been invited to be in. So I'm busily working every day, and I'm very eager for any advice Sherry can say about painting in general. But it's good. I just finished painting a little mountain stream with a big pile of boulders in the foreground, and I've been told that rocks look like they should hurt, and I think these ones do. So that's one mark of something. So I'm doing very well.
Yeah, congratulations on doing your show, too.
Yeah, I'm really excited about that.
Good. So let's bring Sherry in. I'm going to do a little bit of an introduction for Sherry. I'm sure most of the artists that are listening know all about Sherry, but for those who don't, Sherry McGraw has been at the forefront of American art scene for over the last 30 years. And as a young woman in Oklahoma City in 1978, she was urged by her teachers, Richard and Edith Goetz, to move to New York and study at the same Art Students League, where they studied within the lineage of Robert Brackman and George Bridgman. In her initial years at the League, she studied primarily with legendary artist David LaFelle, but also learned anatomy through Robert Beverly Hale, and John, I'm going to say this name wrong, Zahorik, I think is what it is, and Sherry, if I'm wrong, you can correct me, at the New York Academy. And then just after a few years in New York, she was already proceeding to make her own way as an exceptional artist, and began exhibiting and winning awards in shows at the Salmagundi, the National Arts Club, the Washington Square Outdoor Art Exhibit, the Pastel Society, the Hudson Valley Art Association, and many more. By the time she was 30, she was teaching classes at the Art Students League, having been asked to take over those of Thomas Fogarty and Gustav Rayburn, and as well as conduct her own classes. And Sherry currently conducts workshops throughout the country and was an instructor this year, as you mentioned, at Weekend with the Masters. And I had the pleasure of meeting Sherry there. Very, very wonderful lady. Loved talking with her, even if we only did it for a short period of time. Like I said, they kept these folks busy. And then her work has been shown in major institutions, including the National Museum of Wildlife Art, the Gilcrease Museum, the National Cowboy and Western Heritage Museum, and the Tucson Museum, as well as numerous prestigious collections, such as that of Senator John Warner, the Mellon family, the Forbes family, John Mellencamp, George Carlson, Scott Christensen, only to name a few. And she was vice president of American Women Artists. And Sherry, as we've mentioned before, also is the author of The Language of Drawing, a highly acclaimed book. And if you also remember, C.W. Mundy, who was on our show, was raving about this book and also Sherry's approach to drawing on the show. So a special shout-out to C.W. and thank him for, I think he talked to you as well, Sherry, saying that you needed to be on the show. But and with C.W.'s help and also with me meeting Sherry at Weekend with the Masters, we twisted her arm really, really good. So welcome, Sherry, and thank you for joining us tonight.
Hi, Linda. Thanks so much. It's really a delight to be here.
Yeah, well, we're actually very, very thrilled to be here. As soon as I told Blanche and Barbara that you were coming and, you know, you were going to be on the show, they were just as excited as I was. So,
well, that's true. I know, and I recently actually did meet Barbara up at Scott Christensen's up in Victor, Idaho. So that was really, really nice, Barbara, to meet you there.
Yeah, Sherry, that was absolutely delightful.
And as I recall, you were doing very nice landscapes up there then.
Well, you gave me a nice comment right in the middle of a difficult piece that was very encouraging. Even though I ended up killing the piece and scraping it off, I know it had a good start. So anyway, that can happen out there, and it's all part of the learning curve, I think.
Oh, for sure.
I'm going to actually ask Blanche to get us off with the first question to you, Sherry. So, Blanche?
Okay. I'm ready.
Yeah. Sherry, first I want to talk a little bit about your book, The Language of Drawing. There's a little bit more to the title than that. It's really called The Language of Drawing from an Artist's Viewpoint. Can you tell us what makes your book different from other drawing books that we artists may already have?
Yes, no, I'd be happy to. Well, you know, what really started me wanting to write this book was that I was noticing that in drawing classes that something had really shifted from maybe even 50 years ago when if you went in to learn how to draw, there was a drawing class, and then there was an anatomy class, and they were really two separate classes. So in the anatomy class, you learned about anatomy. In the drawing class, you learned what drawing was. And so what my book is about is really about what all good draftsmen have known. So it's what all good draftsmen learn, whether they can articulate it or not. It's what they all know. And it's something very, very different from anatomy, and I just felt that what was happening is that people were thinking that if you, you know, went in to learn how to draw and all they did was teach you anatomy, that must be, you know, getting the anatomy right must be the only thing that drawing is about. And the kind of drawing that I'm really attracted to, you know, that of, say, like, you know, Michelangelo and Van Dyck and Rubens, you know, Rembrandt, that they were all drawing in a from this point of view of what I'm talking about. So it's really from an artistic point of view, you know, not getting hung up on, not on anatomy. And interesting that you should, when Linda mentioned John Zahorek, and I took an anatomy class from him, and he was really, really phenomenal. But it's one case where, you know, he was an artist and then he got sidetracked into anatomy and ended up being an anatomist and having a whole business with that, and he's no longer a practicing artist. And so, I mean, that's an extreme example, but it's what can happen, you know, where you get so sidetracked that you lose sight of the thing that you're really trying to do, which is to really capture the life of a subject on a flat surface, on paper.
I see. Not every single detail, but as an artist sees it.
But right, as an artist sees it. So an artist, you know, uses perspective, uses anatomy in order to you know, hone their way of seeing and in order to make them draw better. But, you know, you don't become an anatomist per se. Or I should say, you know, that there are certain personalities. So actually, like Da Vinci actually was probably the one really true famous anatomist that was also an artist and really thought his drawing was very artistic. But he was an anatomist. That was what he was interested in doing. But, you know, clearly Rembrandt wasn't. Clearly he wasn't.
You make a beautiful case in your book about Michelangelo's drawing of the Libyan Sibyl and
how
he has extra muscles. And the extra muscles could, as you put it, raise the eye of the anatomist, but they're there and they add to the tension of the drawing, knowing that something is being held up, that there's, you know, that tension artistically is incredibly beautiful and is expressed, you know, if you were looking at the anatomy incorrectly, but in terms of the art and of the drawing and of the back, it's absolutely beautiful. And you talk about that in your book.
That's very astute. Yeah, I mean, that is really true. And so you respond to the that kind of connection that the artist has with the subject. And I think that that's when drawing is the most beautiful, is when you find a connection. It's funny because we were just out in L.A. and went to the Getty to a Gustav Klimt show.
Mm-hmm.
And have you guys heard about that show? Or
I heard a little bit about it.
The Klimt show now. Well, it's quite a big show, and it goes from his really early drawings to his late drawings. And it was very, very interesting. I mean, clearly the guy knew how to draw, which means he, you know, understood, you know, reality. He could decipher what he was looking at, and he, you know, he clearly could draw well. There's no argument there. But it was interesting that the early drawings that were very shaded and, you know, much more kind of dimensional, that they lacked a certain kind of tactile quality, you know, of having a connection to the model. And it's interesting that, you know, thinking about your listeners, that it's something that even somebody just beginning to draw can have, is that connection to the model. And it's amazing how then later his drawings were terrific, you know, much simpler, you know, no shading line. And there were two drawings in particular that David LaFell and I, felt just had such a feeling of weight, and yet it was just a single line. And to me, it's the most amazing thing when somebody can do that. And so it was a really interesting thing to see, you know, in the whole exhibit.
Oh, that must have been fascinating.
Oh, it was just fascinating.
In your book, Oh, excuse me, Barbara. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Blanche. Finish your thought, please.
Oh, I was just reading in your book about that the art, some of these artists you don't even need their signature if you're a student of their work. You can tell by the line work that is their signature in a painting.
Right, yeah, both in painting and in drawing. If you spend enough time with an artist's work, you really get a sense of their nervous system. You get a sense of their nervous system. And so that's why in drawing, that's why you have to make a line and really make a committed line. And that's why in painting, you really have to make a brush stroke. because it's in that line, that simple line, and in that brushstroke that whatever each of us are comes out. You know, so if you make a brushstroke and then you start blending it and start, you know, you've taken all that, all of what you are out of the brushstroke.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting. It is because it's what, I mean, we can't help but be what we are anyway all the time. I know, it's like good or bad.
Well, it's also true when you do that brushstroke that you're looking at a shape, and often if you start to second guess that shape and that kind of visceral connection to what it is you're painting, you dilute the shape, you can lose the value, and you end up with some wimpy little shape that's been blended out, and you've lost your original vision, your original decision, and that shape that was described by that brushstroke.
Well, yeah, that is true, and that is a whole other discussion, which I know we're going to get into when we get into abstract realism.
Yeah.
But yes, I mean, everybody does have. No, go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask the question of, in the description of the book, it says, now it's easy to connect beauty of line with beauty of form. So I was wondering if you could talk about the differences between drawing, the beauty of line and painting, and how you brought the two together for artists. And I think that's kind of a nice follow-up to the line and the breaststroke remark that you had just made.
Okay, you know, and when in thinking about this question, you know, I do make a distinction, I mean, about the two languages. So drawing, as I see it, drawing is a linear language. And so the whole thing in drawing is that you create form with not only line, but also then shading form darker to an edge. And so in the language of drawing, it reads for us to model in the light and model in the shadow, because what we're doing is we're creating form. And so for any kind of a realist, that's your number one goal, is to make something look real and have form. So in drawing, right, so in drawing, you know, you're doing that by the manipulation of the line, and also with shading, and you shade in the light and you shade in the shadow. Now, drawing, and the distinction I make in the book is that drawing and painting are two totally different languages. And so the reason drawing works by modeling in the light and modeling in the shadow is because drawings are always intended to be seen up close. And so it's really merely by the distance that we see them. Have you spotted that? And
I think that's a beautiful point that you make in the book, that the viewing distance is very different between a drawing, which is much more intimate in terms of how you see it, you might even hold it, versus a painting, which you'd view at a different distance, further away.
Right, because if you think about it, you know, where did painting begin? You know, it began, it was commissioned by the popes. It was commissioned by the great kings and queens. And so these, you know, buildings were massive buildings. And so the imagery had to read from a distance, a long way.
Mm-hmm.
And so even when they didn't know perspective, and even when they didn't know a lot of things, they figured that much out, that they had to have simple, flat shapes. And so the only place that they transgress that, if you've been in the museums and looked at the early paintings, you know, 15th, 16th, you know, early 16th century, is that they've modeled the faces. So if you get close, they've modeled the faces. They didn't know how to do it any other way. But then the halos are flat, the clothing is flat, everything's flat. And so the interesting thing in painting is that you're trying to create what you were talking about a minute ago, Blanche, about these flat, you know, shapes. Was it Blanche or was it Barbara? Blanche?
I think Barbara was talking about
the shapes. It was Barbara talking about the flat shapes. And so that's what's going to read, and yet how, you know, how we make it look dimensional, we, you know, use warm and cool, you know, warms and cools in order to give the illusion that something has form, something recedes with the cools and advances with the warms.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of a miracle, a visual miracle.
Amazing. It's interesting as well, Sherry, when, you know, I play with drawing. I do not think I'm a very good drawer, but with that in mind, when I play with drawing and you make the comment about it being, you know, the beauty is in the line, I mean, even in a light area, we'll end up putting a line to define that shape, okay? And
right.
we may choose to keep the value the same in our painting and make that a color change in the light
right.
area, or similarly in the dark area. So I guess that to me, that's also a big difference. Like, you know, when I do my drawing as a person that's doing the sketch beforehand, I'm typically thinking of my values and not so much the shape of a boat or the shape of a tree, but more, you know, I'm already thinking in my mind where I place that edge line of the tree that I'm probably just going to let that meld into a color change of the same value.
This is in a preparatory sketch that you're doing,
yes,
Linda?
Yeah. It would never be a drawing that I would, you know, frame and put on my wall, unless it turned out really, really good, but they typically don't. But that's another reason. There's a whole other reason why that happens. But it's a preparatory sketch that I do so that I can get, and we'll talk about it a little bit later, too, that abstract foundation going that makes the whole painting stronger. That's viewable from afar, right?
Exactly. That's the whole key because, I mean, you know, painting, you know, is a communication, and so that is the first thing in the communication is that we've got to somehow make somebody interested from a distance so that then they'll even come to our paintings. And then once we get them there, then there's all kinds of things to keep them there.
Mm-hmm, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So with that in mind, Sherry, can you, I talked a little bit about what I do to start a painting. Can you share a little bit with us about how you start or how you would encourage students in your workshops to start their painting?
Absolutely. Quite typically people start with a linear drawing. So this is, and I'll bet a lot of your listeners, you know, start their paintings with linear drawings. And it seems like a natural thing to do because, you know, drawing is really our first language. I think everybody understands, you know, drawing just even, you know, being born, everybody seems to know how to draw in a way, you know the language, you know. And, you know, kids will make you've asked them to make a sun and they don't hesitate, you know. They make a, you know, round circle and put rays, you know, lines for the rays. So it's interesting. So that's a natural language. So when you start a painting, since the language of painting is very, very different, and it is masses, as you guys have all been talking about. So it is masses. If you start with a mass, so that's how I do it, I start and I really place where the light in the painting is going to be, because what somebody will see our painting by from a distance will be the light shapes. So what I do is, it seems a little bit counterintuitive, but you start it with a dark mass so that you can judge that mass. Now, one reason, too, that you start with the mass and you don't start worrying about it, keeps you from worrying about drawing, so that you just start a mass and you figure out if the size and placement of the light is going to be really where you want it to be. Now, the problem, you know, because the problem with starting with a linear drawing is that if you get a perfect drawing, you know, the chances of changing that drawing are, you know, it's probably not going to happen, you know, because you get attached to your drawing.
Yeah.
I mean, you can do it. I mean, Thomas Moran, you know, started with a a linear drawing. It's just that you can see, I saw a huge show of his up in Seattle. And when he went wrong, you know, he went really wrong. And I think in part it was due to the drawing, because he got so involved in the drawing that he lost sight of his big idea. But when he was good, he was great. He was great. But that is the danger of the linear drawing, is that it can, you know, already shift you away from your visual idea in the painting of, you know, what you really want to do in the painting.
Yeah, that's why I think I only like spending 20 minutes on it at the most. I mean, 5 or 10 minutes is probably even better, just to mass in the shapes. So,
right.
If I find I do a really, really detailed drawing, I find myself that I'm thinking in terms of the boat, the tree, the leaves, the trunk, versus just that dark massed area.
Right, which is really... Yeah. You know, the big size and placement, again, it's what somebody's going to see from a distance. So that means more than anything.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Don't you think?
Oh, I do. I absolutely do.
I've noticed what helps me, especially when I'm out plein air, is to put in, if my goal is to paint light and shadow and to see how light falls on the object, so I'm not necessarily doing, I'm always looking at the values, but I'm really looking at how that light is falling on that scene. And what I'll do is I'll just put in the shadow shapes, those masses of shadows, and the very first cut, I'm not even distinguishing is this in deep shadow or light shadow? I'm just literally looking at, this is all in shadow, and I'm just trying to see, you know, what's light, what's in shadow, and see if that makes a good arrangement of shapes, if that's interesting just to begin. And I found that if I do that when I'm out painting, it really makes a big difference. It all goes much faster. I keep it very clear of what's in sunlight and what's in shadow, and then can just, you know, really, really explore the colors and the shadows. Because Sherry and I are both in New Mexico, and we have very brilliant light here, which tends to wash color out of the light areas.
Oh, yeah.
It's gorgeous here.
Yeah.
Gorgeous.
Yeah.
And plus you're capturing all the shadow shapes. If the light changes, you have your map there. You quickly captured that. Yeah.
Right.
So the things that change on you are not bothering you so much with the light.
Yeah. So 3 hours later, you still have an idea of what you set out to do.
You have your map. Sherry, let me ask you, gesture is an important part of capturing your subject, and it's not just something for portrait painters to understand. We take gesture into the landscape, into landscape paintings. The gesture of a tree or a flower and so on gives it interest and personality. Can you talk about the importance of capturing gesture and provide a few tips on how to do this?
Provide a few tips. Well, over the phone. The painting doctor, over the phone.
It is hard to describe.
We need a visual of this, Sherry. So.
Okay, well, we'll get creative here. Well, you know, it's interesting because certainly everything that you're learning in drawing is helping your painting. So just the fact that what happens when you do a gesture at all is that, and let's just take the human form because it is, you know, traditionally the way that people learn how to draw. And the reason that is that you have all these different parts. You have the torso, you have the head, you have the arms and the legs. So all these different elements. And what you're trying to do in a gesture is you're trying to see them all as one thing. Now, if you look at it and you start to think of it as Barbara, you were talking about, you know, the trunk and the boat and the, you know, everything being separate, then it's, you know, then what happens is that everything does come out separate. So you have to see them all as part of one thing, which is what the gesture is. So the gesture is a unifying just sense of what the subject is doing. And so how that applies, you know, in landscape and with trees and all of that is the same thing, that you have a sense of, actually Ned Jacob once said that, you know, you can't draw a tree unless, you can't paint a tree unless you really can draw it, unless because you have a sense of what's happening with that tree. You know, it's not just a shape, but I mean, and that's something I know Scott certainly, you know, has in his work. It's just a beautiful sense of the gesture of something, and certainly of trees and all of that. And so you have to have that kind of sensitivity, which is, you know, really what drawing, the reason to learn how to draw, is that it awakens all this sensitivity to what you're looking at. And you develop a whole kind of knowledge base of weight, of gesture, you know, dimension, you know, all these things that help you then when you get into painting, then you can just focus on the language, you know, and what it is you're trying to do in the painting.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a beautiful answer. And it seems too like that if you can capture the gesture and the sense of the position and the form and even the weight of a figure or the tree, because, you know, when I'm painting trees, it seems like it's always this constant dialogue between gravity and sunlight. And how are they going to grow if they've been blocked out, you know, not getting enough sun? They're gonna twist a different way to reach the light. And I think that's one thing that I've learned from watching Scott paint trees is he does get that gesture of the tree, and he also gets a very unique and specific feel for this tree. It's almost like there's a personality to that particular tree in that painting.
Right, right.
Oh, that's
right,
wonderful
right.
To think about.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I mean, and it creates such a connection with your subject, which really comes through in your work. I mean, I think probably the biggest piece of advice, you know, for anybody learning, you know, to paint and to draw is really just to pay attention. If you just slow down and pay attention.
Yeah, observation is just so important.
Yeah, I mean, because if you respond to somebody else's work, then it means you have that capacity also, because it means you're seeing it.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Otherwise, you wouldn't see it. So that's a nice thing, too.
Yeah.
It is good to slow down and really, really look at things and open your eyes instead of just what you imagine is there. Really see what's there.
Yes, that is so true, Blanche.
And perspective is also an important part of a painting and drawing, and that is easily misrepresented. If the perspective is off, the viewer knows something's not right, and this can cause the viewer to just, you know, quickly move on. So could you help us understand perspective? Because in your book, you do talk about seeing without measuring. So what are some important things to remember to help get the perspective correct?
Okay. Well, you know, first of all, really, so when you're thinking about measuring, that really has to do with proportion. And so I know my first teacher had taught, you know, to measure, and I'm sure everybody has learned how to do it with the back of a brush, you know, and how to measure things. But the problem, you know, I see with measuring is that if you measure and you always measure, then you'll always have to measure. So if what you want is to be able to simply see it, then you've got to start trusting your eye and take the time to, when you draw something or paint something, see what that relationship is. And what happens is you eventually start to be able to train your eye, and then it becomes, really for me, it's become more accurate than measuring.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, that's, have you guys ever tried that or...
No.
I have not. That's a new concept. That's a great idea.
Well, I love that when I love that when I read it in your book, because I actually taught drawing at the University of New Mexico for 11 years, and I taught in the Department of Architecture, but I was fortunate enough to work with beginning students, and so mm-hmm. we ran the first three quarters of the studio as an art studio, where we drew from the model and we drew portraits and we'd go outside and we would just see the shapes and draw, because it felt so important to me, especially in training architects, that they learn mm-hmm. how to see, and that then mm-hmm. they learn where their body fits into this environment that they're then going to be creating for us to live in. So you know, proportion became, not only do you have to see the proportions of the human figure, but, you know, like if you go into a public restroom and you're in a toilet stall, why is the toilet stall that wide? You know, you kind of have to know where your elbows are, how a body fits into a space. And the more that we actually drew and had to train their eye, and for me it was always an incredible learning experience every semester, when I read that part in your book, I just resonated very deeply with that, because with enough practice I had gotten to a point where I could demonstrate and then teach without the constant measuring. And I was so delighted to see so many of these students picking that up, because, we all learn from mimicking, and that was
a very exciting thing. I think the old architects actually really did know how to draw. I mean, the older architects.
Oh,
they
did. Oh, yeah. My husband can draw. now all computers. Yeah.
Right, which is interesting. I mean, the same thing with all the art directors. They used to be able to draw, too, but now it's all been lost, which is a shame. But, you know, and then the thing that you're experiencing with the architecture and perspective and all of that, I think, you know, certainly we could go into perspective, very, very, at a very complicated level. But what I explain in the book is that, you know, basically you're going to be using two different kinds of perspective, one point or two point. Pretty much, unless you're, you know, going to be doing a very complicated circular stairway or something like that, in which case I would get this one book by Rex Vicket Cole, C-O-L-E, Rex Vicket Cole, and it's Perspective for Artists, and it is it's just an inexpensive little book from Dover Books, Dover Publications. And it will give you the perspective to do absolutely anything. So if you really have a very complicated thing, you can look it up, and he's got it there, and it's really more geared towards artists, you know, not towards architects. But basically, the two simple perspectives, one point and two point, and once you have a sense of what those are and you know what they are, then what it does is it trains your eye so that when you look at something, you can assess what you're seeing, so that you can figure out what has to be happening. And then you eyeball it. I mean, otherwise you'd have to have T-squares and, you know, long, long pieces of butcher paper or something, you know, in order to do it.
Yeah, you can't get them long enough sometimes.
Right, exactly, you can't. I mean, and so artists want to have these skills, but to the degree that they need them. You know, like who was it, Turner? It was Turner and all his Venice watercolors and so forth. Well, Turner had some architectural background, and so it's only natural that that's what he's would have been drawn to, is this architectural world, you know, and to do it so simply. You could see that his whole focus wasn't to prove how, you know, correct he could make the perspective, but it was really a beautiful artistic, you know, idea, abstract idea, which we'll be talking about in a minute.
Yeah. You know, when I was teaching the students, it was interesting to me that it was such a glorious revelation when you know, you're talking about vanishing line and the students are looking at you like, what? And then you're talking about horizon line and they're thinking about a literal horizon line out there that they can see where the earth meets the sky. And and to say, hey, no, actually the horizon line is your eye level and it goes with you wherever you go. And once you know that that horizon line is based on you and it's coming from your brain and your eyes and how you look out, then mm-hmm. you'll start to see, based on where you're standing, you know, or sitting or whatever, the whole perspective is going to change based on you. And right. that was always, you know, a huge breakthrough for folks. It's like, oh, it's not this abstract thing I'm having to learn from a book, but it's really a visual experience that I can embrace and learn viscerally.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Yeah, that's a great point, Barbara, yeah.
Okay. So are there any other questions or that we want to cover on the language of drawing or gestures or perspective before we move into abstract realism?
Oh, I just love the idea of just sort of learning more about 1-point and 2-point perspective, but don't take it too far, and then it teaches you just to look out there and know what you need to look for.
Yeah. Right. I mean, it's the same thing with. It can be, and it's the same thing, you know, with anatomy. I mean, you know, there are certain people, like there's, you know, Robert Liberace. I don't know if you guys know about him, but you know, he's probably one of the foremost anatomists, you know, today. I mean, he knows absolutely everything in the body, every origin, every insertion of every muscle. He knows, you know, everything, and which is phenomenal. But even he says, you know. That in part it's his quirk that this is what he wants to he enjoys knowing it at that level. I mean, just like it was with John Zahorek, but it isn't necessary. It isn't necessary.
Yeah.
I think that's what also, you know, your listeners, you know, might want to realize too, is that there's a lot of things with artists that are just peculiar to their personalities. And
mm-hmm.
you have to weed through that to realize what's really necessary, you know. So my particular mind doesn't work that way, that to need to know every, you know, origin, insertion, every name of every muscle, but to have much more of a visual appreciation and a visual read of what you're looking at. And that's what knowledge of anatomy, and you do want to have knowledge of anatomy, but you don't, you want to just be careful that it's not taking over the whole your whole intent. I mean, is that why you're doing it?
Mm-hmm.
Is to impress people with how much anatomy you know?
Medical drawing.
Well,
your viewpoint makes it
Sherry,
much
reading.
I'm sorry. Your viewpoint makes it much easier for people to learn to draw if they don't think they have to master every bit of it.
Right, right, right. Is that you're going for, you know, why you're doing it, you know, and I think, you know, that really artists tend to be a pretty generous, you know, lot of people, because they see something beautiful and they have this urge to want to, in a sense, convey that beauty to another person. And I think the whole thing is to keep your eye on that. You know, why are you really doing this?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot
to
learn. There's a lot to know, but.
Yeah, I was just, I have your book in front of me, which is a constant source of inspiration, Sherry, but I would just like to share with others, there's several lines in here that I think pertain not only to art and to drawing, but they have the level of a spiritual truth for me when I read them. But if I could read these, it says, you've written, it could be argued that this desire is the generous inclination that most artists share. The impulse to capture beauty and, in effect, preserve it for all time. But when solutions arise prior to seeing the subject and not as a response to it, the procedure is forced on the model and nothing new happens. Beautiful drawing is a direct record of something learned. You know, that to me is
a call
to stay present and to keep looking and see, and seeing is the true teacher. And then later in the book, it just, you know, so on page 92, I marked it, put an arrow on it, but you wrote, reality is not fixed. The mind creates the concept of right and wrong, but that distinction is only an idea. Right and wrong do not exist in nature, just bad relationships. I just loved that. I can go for people, for art, for painting, for drawing. It's all right there. Thanks for writing that.
Well, thank you. I'm so happy you appreciate that. It's funny, it's been a long time since I've read it, so that was nice to hear again.
Yeah, I mean, it struck me. And the last one that I marked, I mean, I hate it to actually mark in the book because it's so beautiful, but I didn't want to lose these pieces. But, you know, you have one that's also called A Solution for Both Languages. And one solution bridges painting and drawing and involves making form. And you have this part in bold. In both languages, more comes forward. This translates as darker value. For example, the nose comes forward by making the value of the entire nose darker than the cheeks. This separates the nose from the cheeks by a slight value shift. And, you know, it's like a smaller form. You say the reason for this is a smaller form. The nose cannot hold as much light as a larger, flatter form of the cheek. And that would be the same for the thigh and the knee and so forth. And, you know, I thought, oh, that's just, it is such a beautiful explanation for a visual truth. And that was the third thing. I just was so excited when I read that.
Well, I know. And when I learned it all, it was just, it was exciting. I mean, I didn't get taught this in depth, but I did learn it and then figured out what I'd learned, you know, and then that's when I finally came up with all these things that I could see in all good drawings. All good drawings knew good draftsmen knew these things, and so that's what I wanted to put down, is that, you know, if you want to draw well, that's what, these are the things you have to heighten your awareness of.
Yeah. Well, and then your ability to translate what you've seen and what is visually expressed in the drawing into these words is, it really, even your writing is a work of art. So it's been a real joy to own this book.
Oh, well thank you.
Yeah,
it is an amazing book. I just got mine when we did the radio show with CW a little bit after that. So I haven't even finished it yet, Sherry. But I'm loving it.
Oh, well, thank you. I know, and CW, I mean, you guys, I know you had him on the show a few weeks ago, CW Mundy, and he was amazing. He was, you know, as you know, in my class for a week, and I have just never had anybody make that much improvement in such a short time. It was amazing. And what was amazing to me is that, you know, here he is, a very established artist, you know, as he would say, you know, one of the brand names in the business, and yet he had the humility to, you know, see what he, you know, to recognize something that he didn't know, and to see that he wanted it, and then to do what he had to do to get it. And it is a very humbling thing, you know, when you've been, you know, a professional for a while, to put yourself in that position of being a student. And anyway, I was in awe of him for many reasons, but that, you know, the fact that he could be so humble, put his, you know, ego aside, what he knew, and actually learn, and I think that's why he learned so rapidly, you know, and then to make such changes, it was really, really remarkable.
Well, he said it was an epiphany for him.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, he is something. He's so open, and it's a lovely quality to have, just to be willing to learn.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, and I think you can just about call him a disciple of yours now, Sherry, because I sat in on one of his demos at Weekend with the Masters, and he was again giving you the same credit that he did on his show. And since we're all, you know, talking about how great your book is and all that, I want to put a note in here. You can order Sherry's book from Sherry. Tell us your website where they can order the book so that we get it right.
Yes, you could order it at www.brightlightfineart.com. So you'll find it there, and we have actually a very special promotion going on until October 31st. So you can find that there.
Great. There's also a link on the show page to Bright Light Fine Art. Is that what you said, Sherry? I'm sorry.
Yes. Yes, that's
yes,
right.
Yes, so there's a link on the show page, too. If you scroll down, you'll see that link. You can go there to order Sherry's book and see the special offer that she has going on. So we've got about 40 minutes left, believe it or not. See how time flies when we're having fun.
Oh, my gosh.
So I want – I know.
Yeah, this is sad.
You've got some things that you need to move to or move on to as well, Sherry, so I appreciate you coming on the air with us. But I do want to talk about abstract realism for a minute, and I or two. And I think it's important for our
or 40.
Or 40, yeah. Well, 39 now, but who's counting? I think it's important for our listeners to understand what abstract realism is. So can you provide us first with a little definition, if you will?
Yes, yes, I could. You know, abstract realists are people that are not painting subject matter as much as they're painting what the subject matter allows them to do in a visual idea that they have in their heads. You know, so it's and that's why the term, you know, abstract realism, which is really an oxymoron, you know, you can't, it's hard to think that abstract and realism could be, in, you know, right next to each other. But there are some people in the history of art that have thought about painting this way, that they have an abstract visual idea and the subject matter simply helps them flesh out that idea. And not that it has nothing to do with the subject, because certainly the subject is inspirational, but that, in other words, like you would be seeing a dark shape, you know, or seeing like, you know, somebody's dark black hair as a dark shape, and that would be used in a particular way in the painting, and some color relationships in the painting would be used, you know, just to create a certain visual idea in the painting. And certainly, you know, visual concepts are hard to talk about because they are visual. And,
right.
You know, as you know, I mean, and what they depend upon is that the artist is looking at reality and taking what he can use, he or she can use, in order to do what they want to do in the painting. So it's completely inspired by the subject, but at the same time, there is a very abstract appreciation of what they're seeing. And so you're using elements to do particular things in the painting, you know, move the eye, you know, through the painting. You know, the painting might be more about air, might be more about color, might be about, you know, size relationships, value relationships, you know. There's just, of course, as many, you know, ideas as there are, you know, artists.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting, because when you said, you know, when you mentioned the darkest value may be the value of the hair on a person, it might, the thought that popped into my mind was, or the image that popped into my mind was Mary Cassatt's Mother and Child painting.
Yes, yes,
yeah.
Yes. And, yeah, very much so.
Then, right, and then when you mentioned, you know, the use of color relationships, one of Fetchin's paintings popped into my mind, because I just love Fetchin for his color relationships, and it's so it was that was interesting that when just you saying those particular phrases, and that's the image that popped up.
Well, that is interesting. See, yeah, that is fascinating. Yeah, and it's really the undercurrent. It's really the thing that, you know, a viewer will be attracted to the subject matter, but the thing that keeps somebody coming to that painting for centuries has to do with this other quality. I mean, usually. I mean, of course, depending on the taste of the viewer, but the paintings that really do have staying power. And, you know, like, let's take Rembrandt. I mean, he would be the father of abstract realism. And what has made him be known really as perhaps the greatest artist that's ever lived, you know, is this quality. In fact, I was just at the Getty, and they have this one little tiny painting of a rabbi on loan of Rembrandt's. And it was amazing because all around it, you know, Jacob Jordan's, and there were all these other artists, I can't think of their names right now. They were all Dutch, and, you know, big compositions and all this stuff. And yet somehow you were drawn to this painting where the light on the face was probably an inch and a half, maybe 2 inches, you know, by two or something. And that was the whole painting, basically. I mean, you know, all the other stuff was kind of background, his, you know, clothing and everything else, the background. And yet that little 2 inch by 2 inch piece of painting was so compelling that it made you want to look at that and not anything else in the room.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing?
I had the actual pleasure of seeing Rembrandt in America, the exhibition. It was down at the North Carolina Museum of Art, and now I believe it's in Minnesota before it, I believe, heads overseas. But the whole Rembrandt in America was paintings that were attributed to Rembrandt before that are now in question right next door, right? I mean, you have one that's now in question right next to one that Rembrandt signed and is definitely a Rembrandt. And it was interesting to walk through there and see that. And they actually made a PBS show out on, it was just on the other night, so it's probably out on all the PBS stations to come, where they had people talking about how they are going back now and looking at Rembrandt's style and saying that, oh, he probably may have painted the face on this one and the student finished, you know, the areas around them. And so it's, mm-hmm. it was really interesting to hear them, like, decipher and how they're deciphering, you know, Rembrandt's code, if you will, to figure out what truly was a Rembrandt and what is not.
Well, you know, a few years back, actually, there was an art dealer in California that had the possibility of handling a Rembrandt in New York City. And so we flew out there to take a look at it, and he wanted our opinion as to whether or not it was really a Rembrandt. And it was funny, when we first walked in, it seemed like it was a Rembrandt. You know, it had all the markings of a Rembrandt. And we stood with it for a good hour, you know, just really studying it. And the longer we looked at it, the worse it got. And by the end of it, we determined that there were some of Rembrandt in it. So, you know, again, if you've spent enough time with an artist, you begin to know their brushstrokes.
We
could see the part that Rembrandt had touched, but we could see a lot that obviously a student had done, because it was things that Rembrandt wouldn't have done. You know, a painting starts to fall apart. I mean, a lesser painting starts to fall apart the longer you look at it. I mean, the longer you look at a bad painting, it starts to fall apart. And the longer you look at a good painting, the better and better it gets.
Right.
And that's why, you know, good paintings in the museums can have somebody coming. You know, you can, century after century, people coming to admire it and learning more and more from it.
Yeah, and it's so true. That is so true, because I don't consider myself a student of Rembrandt. I don't, like, study him a lot, but by the time I got through that, the ones that were really pulling my eye that I really wanted to go back and revisit were the ones that were, you know, no questions asked. This was totally Rembrandt. And I got to the point where I stopped reading the cards and would just stand there and look for clues that would say that it wasn't. And
yeah.
Like I said, I don't...
So you're beginning to recognize it, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
you know, so
great.
You know,
when I was an art student in France, I came across this quote that Rembrandt wrote on drawing by his student, Van Hoogstraten. And it's quite beautiful, because it is talking about drawing, and it's short if you'd like me to read it.
Sure.
He says, copying the drawings of masters was a habitual exercise in his studio, meaning in Rembrandt's studio. The sketch of the whole, emphasizing the essential elements, was at the base of this exercise. The sketch should already express the character of the represented objects. Contours should be drawn, not in the continuing manner, but rather fragment by fragment, with a lightness of hand, that the object be not closed, but open to the light, that it may breathe in the enveloping atmosphere. The placement of the shadows is very important. Even from the beginning, they should be accurately placed. It is the placement of the shadows and their harmonious rapport upon which depends the luminous effect of the whole. One must leave the paper the power to act by itself in order to give birth to the light. Drawing may be defined as a harmonious rapport of the shadows.
That's interesting.
You know, I read this and I having read your book and how you were talking about seeing, draw the air around the figure.
Well, that is so great. Yeah, that is so great.
Yeah,
well,
I'll send you a copy of it if you would like.
Oh, sure. I would love it.
Yeah, it's entitled Rembrandt on Drawing During His Teaching Years, 1640 to 1648, as told by his student Van Hoogstraten.
Oh, yeah, Hoogstraten.
Anyway,
yeah.
It's funny what you run into when you are poking around little bookstores in south of France when you're an art student. So.
and give me the title of the book, too, and then I'd love to try to get it. That would be great.
I don't have the book itself. This is just a fragment of a page
that I wrote down
from the book. So I'll send you all what I've got, or send it to Linda, too, if she's interested in posting it on the AMLO site. But,
we can do that. Yeah, copy me on that, Barbara.
Sure, yeah.
Sherry, a little earlier we were talking about abstract starts to paintings and getting a great foundational start. Do you think having a great abstract start is important for a strong painting?
Well, absolutely. Because what it indicates is that the thinking is about what the idea is in the painting, about what you want the painting to look like. This abstract vision of what you want the painting to look like. And so if you start with that abstract idea in your head and you continue trying to create that beauty that you're seeing, you know, from your subject, not just simply copy the subject, then you'll end up with a painting that has the beauty in it that you saw. I mean, the tricky part is that we see the beauty, but you can't just get it all on the canvas at one time. So then you start to paint it piece by piece, and that's when it falls apart almost always.
Yeah, you lose sight of the beauty, of the whole.
Exactly, and then you end up, you at the end of the day, and you think, well, this isn't what I wanted it to look like.
Yeah.
And it's because you weren't painting the idea all along. But, I mean, I'm sure you guys have all had that experience of having a painting that just painted itself,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
You know, it just seemed to kind of go great from beginning to end. And it's because you saw what you wanted to do, you saw the idea, and then you just, that's all you did was the idea. And you didn't get, especially in landscape, distracted by this, cloud moving and shadows moving and the color moving, the light moving.
Right.
And and you're just painting the idea all the way through.
Yeah, I see. And then otherwise you would end up with just a picture of what you see, like a snapshot or a photograph that's really not the big idea. The beauty.
Because the possibilities of what you can put down are so vast.
Mm-hmm.
We don't. I mean, just like I was saying in the book. I mean, we tend to think that reality is pretty fixed, and there's a right and wrong value and color, but it isn't true. There are all kinds of ways of seeing something. You know, you can see it. Like, for instance, you could. There's this one stellite painter, Hofse Puschmann, Hovsep, and then Puschmann, and he died, I think, maybe in 1965. Primarily a still life artist, and this friend of mine owns a couple of them, but the same object is in both of these paintings. And in one painting, he has one totally different idea that has to do with color. And so he paints the object, truthfully, but looking for color. And so the whole painting is much more colorful. And then the second painting was about the light falling on the print in the background, all the objects. And it's a completely different interpretation of the color of that object. And yet there's no question but it's the same figurine. But there's two completely different points of view, two completely different visual ideas. And so you then extract that information for that idea. I mean, that's what people don't realize. They think, well, if I just put down everything that I'm seeing, it's going to look like it, but it won't.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's editing we have to do.
Yes, it's very deceptive. You know, we tend to think it's so black and white, but it isn't. I mean, we really do see through, you know, a scrim of our own life experience and our own way of seeing the world. I mean, it's part of the beauty of each artist because they are seeing through their, you know, their whole being, you know, and that's why different artists' work, you know, is different.
And talking about our friend CW as well, is he talks about it being the directorship of his painting. You know, he's got to be the director. Why does a movie win? You know, why does the movie win best movie? Because it has also probably got the best director, and you know, maybe not necessarily the best actors in the world, but if you've got a great director, you can make, you know, a not so good actor shine. So you know, it's the same thing as you have to be in command of your paintings. So I know I sounded like CW.
I was just going to add, because what Sherry is saying is, you know, very reminiscent of what Kwang Ho also talks about. He says that our perception is so limited by what we believe, and, you know, if we're just going to paint the object and try to paint it as something out there as object, basically we end up projecting ourselves onto the object, and rather than trying to let the object itself become part of a visual dialogue and a visual approach. And it might be that your abstract idea for that, as you were saying earlier, Sherry, could be the color, or it could be the light and shadow, or it could be a separate dark light pattern, or just all about values and tones. And that idea, based with kind of letting go of ego and letting go of projecting yourself onto that object, you can get to another level of awareness in your painting of, you know, is this a true statement or not? You know, and you're exploring and discovering at a whole other level than just trying to render an object.
I mean, that is really an excellent point. I mean, it's so true. And I think that that's where, you know, formulas come into being, is that, you know, people want to make sure that they do something reasonable every time. And so they try to repeat the same steps that they've done in a painting. And then, as you were suggesting, you know, it becomes all the artist. And there's nothing of the subject, and so we don't get to the artist doesn't get to learn anything. Their work doesn't change. Nothing new happens. So
yeah,
no, I think that's
so. Originality becomes more about, you know, being true. What's true out there? And I think that's such a huge struggle to get out of ourselves, and to just let something new come in.
Right. Yeah, and unless you want to do the same painting every day for the rest of
That's
your life.
That's right. That could be so boring. Especially because it would probably be an ugly painting if you did it that way. That would be depressing.
Yeah.
Well, one of our last questions that we were developing for you is, beyond our signatures on a painting, and you've mentioned this before and already and talked a bit about it with the Rembrandt and how you look to see if this was truly a Rembrandt and, you know, or not, but that the trained eye can identify works of the past masters, such as Hals, Van Dyck, Rubens, Rembrandt, without the help of their signatures. And on your website, you say a lot of beautiful things on your website, and one of them is, to the casual viewer, there is little or no distinction, but to the observant eye, there is a world of difference. Each of these artists has distinctly different intentions and paint applications, which are, in fact, their true signatures.
Mm.
Can these differences be interpreted as their unique voice? And does our unique voice actually start at the foundation of the painting?
I think that's a great question. I mean, I think that it's, you know, probably one of the big worries of most art students is that, you know, they want to, you know, be who they are, and there's a lot of talk about, you know, one's voice and all of that, and it is true, but it's funny, the more one tries, I think the more one loses that voice in a funny way, that you have to, it's just simply, in a funny way, I think you almost have to give yourself over to these things and not be afraid of losing yourself. I think that's actually when you find yourself, ironically.
Yeah.
You know, because if you're holding on to what you are, I mean, it's such a desperate thing when really we can't help but be who we are. I mean, there's really no way around it. We just are who we are. Even if we're trying to imitate somebody, we're still who we are. You know, so if you just don't worry about that part and you let go and really, you know, like we were talking about earlier about paying attention and really observing and your subject, then you begin to learn. And it's actually when the most truthful, the most beautiful things come from that. And you can spot that. I mean, I've been teaching for so long. It's you know, maybe it's in part because I have been teaching for so long, but I can look at a painting and I can tell you, you know, a lot about the artist, you know, the person who painted it, because you can tell what their intent is, you know, why they're doing it. You just, everything about it. You can, you know, see if there's too much ego in it, if they're just trying to impress you, were they really moved by the beauty they saw? I mean, it's interesting, and it's not as though it requires, you know, 20 years of painting for that to happen. I mean, it can happen in the first painting. It can happen in the first painting.
I think so many artists are struggling to find their voice for years. and you're saying it's there all along if they get out of the way of it.
Well, it is. It is. I mean, the thing is, though, now maybe other people won't see it. And I think that, you know, what we're up against today, because it's such a commercial world and there's so many people out there painting, the tendency is to want to grab onto some sort of a gimmick or something that will distinguish you from the other painter. And it's, you know, it's certainly something that, you know, will do that, but you won't really find out what you have to say if you do that. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You know, just trying to find a gimmick.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Which isn't really somebody's
product.
True voice. I mean, it's, you know, and we live in such a commercial time, you can see how people think that they just have to yell louder than the person next to them, you know.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes when you do something I had a friend who one time asked me, you know, when I was going to start painting my own paintings. And I must say, it made me kind of mad. And I said, well, I'll tell you what. I said, I'll put you in a room, and I'm going to cover up the signatures of these paintings, but I'm going to have a Van Dyck, I'm going to have a Rubens, a Rembrandt, and a Hals. And I said, now you tell me which is which. Now, and then that did kind of shut him up. And I said, because is it their fault that you can't tell the difference?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's something to think about, because should Rembrandt have changed? Should Hals have
changed?
That's right. Just because you can't see the difference. And I think that, you know, people's sensitivity to the really beautiful, beautiful differences between human beings is kind of lost in this time, because we're in such a commercial time.
Yes.
You know, that, and so people are kind of losing that beauty of that very sensitive, subtle differences between human beings, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, when you get to know somebody's work, it's actually much more obvious, the differences, when you really, really study somebody's work and get familiar with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great
advice, Jerry.
So you don't have to try.
the really hard part is, you know, we're such control freaks that how do you get yourself out of the way when you're such a control freak? You know? Thank God you get into zones and you don't think about those things, right? Get into the zone and start painting.
Well, but see, now that's a great thing to realize about oneself, and then kind of see how that unfolds in a painting. Like, what does that mean? What does that mean in my painting? Because I think most artists are. I mean, we're all, you know, obsessive compulsive. You have to be. I mean, it's actually a requirement, I think, to be an artist.
I think so too.
And then, you know, most of us, I mean, if you really care about things, you know, there is that desire to control it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's not necessarily a bad thing, but but then just to see how it manifests.
Right.
Well, and then there's that interesting thing that, you know, was recently pointed out to me by Scott Christensen when I was painting, and it was one of these incredible life lessons. But he came up and I was working on this piece, and I was tired. I've been painting all morning, and as I was tired, I went back to a default way of doing things that I had no idea was a default of this is what I do when I'm tired. And I had a little dialogue in my head, and I learned through, you know, just a lot of awareness. So it wasn't control necessarily I was after, but awareness of what is my pattern when I'm tired or anxious and the painting isn't quite going correctly, you know, correctly meaning it's not coming alive.
Mm-hmm.
What do I do? And through his comments, I was actually able to come to another level of awareness and recognize in myself, all right, when I'm tired, I may then make a real bold move that's unnecessary in this painting. And I tend to do that because maybe I'm getting tired and I don't want to make the subtle changes to a value mass, which would actually move the painting along. I get impatient and then do a bold move and would then need to probably scrape it off to get back to bringing the piece alive. But it seems like, you know, that self-awareness of what is it you do when you're tired, and I found that those same kinds of things that I do in my painting are probably things that I also do in my life or in relationships. And so it was a interesting kind of awareness. You know, I started to be able to look at my paintings and then read myself better. And, you know, I think that's also the gift of having a good teacher is they can...
That really
knows that language. Yeah, they can start to see where you're going wrong necessarily. And for me, it was like, slow down. You've got something that's working. Just slow down.
Right. That's wonderful to be able to pinpoint those things. It's hard to see those things in yourself.
Much easier to see in somebody else.
Right. It's always much more difficult to own your own stuff.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So much easier to project it out there.
Okay, well, we are down to about the last 12 minutes of the show, so I want to get in. Blanche, do you have a last question or statement that you want to make?
Yes. Sherry, I was looking over your book, and back to drawing again. You were talking about the patience you need in learning to draw and learning to see. You can work on something a long time, but you may have to develop your knowledge of it to actually be able to see it and do it, to actually see it and execute it in the way you should. And I just enjoyed reading about learning to have patience with yourself. I think you were talking about learning to foreshorten something. You had to keep looking at it and looking at it and doing it and giving yourself time to understand it.
Well, and I mean, the irony is that, you know, my students learn all of this so much quicker than I did. Because I didn't really have anybody quite holding my hand through it, you know, so it would have been, anyway, but so, yes, I had to figure out all that stuff and why, and it just seems to be the way my mind works. I just have a pretty logical mind, and I, you know, like to know, you know, why about things and understand it, so... Yes, but patience, I have developed a lot of patience, and I think all artists need to.
Yeah, it's hard to have that one. Things aren't going well, and it can get frustrating. But once I read that, I realized it doesn't all happen in one day.
Well, and I think it was maybe Paul Strzok. I don't know if you knew him, but he was an Eastern artist up in the New England area. And he said that you can't be the artist today that you're going to be in 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for so
That's
many
brilliant.
Of us, we just
nice.
Want to jump to 5 years, you know, but
uh-huh.
you just have to paint those paintings, make the mistakes, you know, be frustrated, you know, jump up and down, you know, stomp on them, and you have to go through all of that. There's no shortcut.
Yeah.
But it's all normal.
Yeah.
It's all normal. Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing is that I think, you know, people think it should somehow go, you know, perfect every time, but you wouldn't learn a thing if it did.
Right.
That's right. Yeah.
There's no shortcut. I think we heard that through all of our protege lessons with Kevin McPherson. So.
Oh, yes. I love Kevin. I just saw him last night.
Did you? Okay. That's actually why I didn't answer my email. Okay.
That's right. No, we were having dinner up at the St. Bernard, and he was actually telling me about his trip to China and that he's learning Chinese and exploring a whole new avenue of painting. He's exploring portraiture.
Yeah, he is. And I think he's with Carolyn Anderson is in town, I think.
She is, Carolyn and CW.
Yeah.
They were all there last night. So.
Yeah, and I think Kevin is actually working with Carolyn in one of her workshops. I think he's taking her workshop,
he
if
is.
I'm not mistaken.
He is.
Yeah.
That's absolutely right, yeah.
So, I mean, you know, just to know that, I mean, I can't imagine having somebody in, like, Kevin or you or Carolyn or CW in one of my workshops. Not that you ever would, but it was just, you know, it would freak me out. Like, I don't know how you guys deal with that. But anyway, getting back to Barbara, last comment or question?
Well, I guess I have more of a comment and an appreciation, but I was able to look at one of your paintings at Scott Christensen's house when we were all up there, and I studied it for a bit, and you know what occurred to me when I was looking at that is that you had really transcended the subject matter. You really transcended the still life, and what that painting was really about was, you know, the harmony of the paint and the colors and the visual elements that you used and expressed. That became the point of the painting, and the thing that just, you know, was just your use of paint itself was luscious. And as I looked at that, it was like the paint in and of itself had such a beautiful, expressive language to it that I just, it was very inspiring. And it, you know, it took me to another level of like, okay, again, it's really not about the subject matter. It really is, you know, if painting is all about relationships, then the relationship between, you know, myself, my soul, and what I'm painting has to be included and be the point of the painting, you know, that anyway, that your painting was so strong, I felt like I was having a dialogue with it, and I just wanted to express that to you and that was a powerful experience for me.
Wow. Well, thank you, Barbara. I mean, that is such an astute comment because it's something we didn't quite touch on, but I'm glad that you've brought it up, is that it's another reason why you don't put in everything that you see in a painting, because you don't want to dominate the conversation. And every painting is a dialogue between you and the viewer. And if you leave it open, you leave room for the viewer to come in. And then it does become a dialogue instead of, you know, when you're bored by a painting, it's really just a monologue. They're telling you everything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the other is much more interesting and much more engaging.
Yeah,
that draws the viewer.
Well, and then, you know, to see your painting and then have that opportunity to meet you and have, you know, a dialogue with you, the real person. it really is, you know, to me, all about relationships.
It is. I mean, that's the most powerful thing in our lives. So a painting, for it to have power, I think it has to also have a relationship with those that view it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
This has really been delightful, I have to say, Linda and Blanche and Barbara.
Did you say frightful?
Pardon?
Did you say frightful, Sherry, or delightful?
Oh, delightful. Delightful.
Okay, I was like, frightful? What do we do?
Sherry, we really appreciate you taking the time to be with us tonight.
Well, it's really been fun. I originally thought an hour and a half. Oh my heavens, this will be a long time.
It always seems like that before we get going.
But no, it's been delightful, and I would love to sit around and just talk about art with you guys someday. So, let's do
we
that.
We would love to have you back, naturally, too.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, we'll keep that in mind, and I know how to get a hold of you now. So,
okay.
Definitely. Would love to have you back. And I know our viewers, our listeners would as well. So what's coming up with you next, Sherry? What do you have going? Workshops, shows, exhibits?
Let's see. Actually, I do the biggest thing right now is that I'm painting for a solo exhibit at the Butler Museum in Youngstown, Ohio in 2014. Am I?
You're going to be by? Yeah, I'm not right by me, but I mean a couple hours away. So
really, where are you located, yeah. Linda?
I'm located between Cincinnati and Dayton, and
great.
Yeah, so please,
you'll
keep
have
in
to
touch
come.
And, yes, obviously yes. So yeah, keep in touch if you're on the road or whatever and need a place, you know where I am. So. Drop me a line,
great.
And I'll definitely be on the way up. I'll come up to see you, that's for sure. That's in
2014? 2014, uh-huh. And it'll be part retrospective and part, you know, new paintings and drawings. So it'll be, it should be a pretty big exhibit, and really, really looking forward to it. I very much like the director, Luzona, and I'm just delighted we're going to do it, so...
Okay, great. You
and,
your
and
congratulations.
Oh, thank you. I know, I'm so thrilled. Actually, CW has been talking to me about doing a workshop with him, a drawing workshop up in his studio in Indianapolis. So you can watch for that on the Bright Light Fine Art website, because I'll probably do something next year with him. And he wants to... help me. He wants to be my assistant, so that I think he can, you know, really solidify what he's learned and get that much better, and then be able to teach it. So I can't think of a more enthusiastic protege. So
yeah.
Will you be doing anything closer to home?
Greedily. I'm not doing a whole lot of teaching for the next couple of years because of this show, but whatever I do will be on the website. So, you know, either mine, you know, sherrymcgraw.com or Bright Light Fine Art. So either one. I'll post everything. I'm going to do something in Cincinnati. I mean, in Connecticut in May. So I'm definitely doing that, and then Baltimore right before that, and then the Portrait Society right before that. So kind of April and May of next year I'll be out and about.
Okay, great. Well, make sure that you I'll make sure to check out your website as well, but make sure that you drop me a note if you're looking for some PR on that, because they're glad to put it out on the website. And and I'll probably end up over at CW's because he's only 2 hours away from me, too. So.
Oh, fantastic. Okay. It's all perfect.
Okay. Well, we need to wrap up, and definitely want to say thank you, Sherry, so much for being with us. And we enjoyed the last hour and a half. It went entirely too fast. Our next show is going to be on September 25th with Michael Pierce, and we'll be talking about the Representational Arts Conference and also his show that just went up at the Carnegie are two of the subjects that we'll be talking about. So, again, thank you very much, Sherry. We so enjoyed having you with us.
Thank you all. Yeah, I enjoyed it, too.
Thank you. Thank you. Good
thank
night.
Thank you, Sherry. I learned a lot.
Great. Well, great.
Okay.
It was really a delight.
Yep. And everybody, have a good evening, and tune us back in on, actually, it's at 1:30 in the afternoon with Michael Pierce. And Sherry, you have a great class tonight, and we'll talk to you soon, hopefully.
Okay. All right. Good night.
Good night.